So today we're going to look at this idea of cultural captivity. It was our focus last week. This time we're going to look at some of the false views. So you might turn with me to Colossians 2. We're going to work through four different views. How is it that people become culturally captive to the culture? We're going to look at some of that, and even though it's going to be a little bit like philosophy, I think you'll be able to follow it very easily. But I wanted to start, maybe since we got early, and Parker's done such a good job of ending the messages early, so I have enough time to cover this, with maybe hearing a story of a young girl who came to Plano, Texas here, and got culturally captive. Now, hers were more peer pressure and all sorts of other issues, but I think it underscores why we're doing this series, because of the need to reach out to the millennial generation. So let's hear a little bit of her testimony.
When I was growing up, I grew up in a Christian family. We've gone to the same church since we moved down here. Going into my freshman year, I really struggled with not knowing who I was. Going into high school, you want to be the biggest and the baddest, you want to have the prettiest friends, you want to have the most active social life. I went to the closest people I could find that looked like they had it all together. These four girls, they made me feel like I was a part of something. They made me feel loved and comfortable. We decided that we wanted to start partying, and we would basically train ourselves to get wasted and look good at it. We started to smoke weed a little bit, and we basically lost our filter. We'd start to experiment with pain medication and muscle relaxers and Adderall. It got to the point where we were drinking every night. We would smoke after we had been drinking. We would take a couple pills, not knowing what they were exactly, after we had been drinking, and just hope for the best. Ultimately, the group of people that we wanted to be hanging out around were guys. We felt like the attention from guys is what really gives a girl status in high school. A lot of these guys would get us under as deep in, under the influence as they could, and ask us to do things with each other. I really lost my faith. I would go to church and I would justify a lot of my bad decisions by saying, oh, I went to church today. It doesn't matter if I was hungover at church. I mean, I was still there. Everyone saw me there. So, I'm a good Christian. One night, these four girls, they left me in a car when I was drunk. They took my money and went into IHOP and spent my money on food. And I don't really remember. I guess I blacked out. After that, our friendship wasn't really the same. As soon as they realized that I was more slowing them down, they basically kicked me out of their group. Ultimately, they kind of broke my heart, because I didn't know who I was outside of these girls, and I had chosen to define myself through them instead of defining myself through Christ. Now I can see that God was really working in my life the entire time, that He never went anywhere, but I went off in my own direction, and I didn't really have a lot to fall back on except for my faith. It was the best thing that ever happened to me, that they didn't want anything to do with me anymore. I try to spend as much time as I can with God, because He's my best friend. I don't need everybody else's love. He gives me enough on His own.
This a little bit relates to this idea of a detour, in case that detour was a pretty dramatic one, but I think it illustrates again exactly why we're studying this, because we recognize, as we've talked about before in some of these surveys, that individuals really are not thinking biblically about these issues and not living biblically. And so as you see in the handout here, I wanted to spend just a minute on this idea of what we talk about in terms of developing a biblical worldview or a biblical mind. And it's interesting because back in the 1960s, there was a book by Harry Blamires, who is English, and he actually argued that there was no longer any way in which Christians were engaging the mind. As a matter of fact, you've seen the old thing, a mind is a terrible thing to waste. Well, that's a secular view, but in the Christian view, he concluded, even back in the 1960s, there's no longer a Christian mind, a real need for us to think biblically about every area of life. A more recent book is one that I think is very helpful, and that is Nancy Piercy. who's co-authored different books with Chuck Colson, and this is her book, Total Truth. She also teaches at Houston Baptist University. And you have this kind of what you call sacred-secular dichotomy. You know, we have things in the sacred realm, you know, and then we have the secular realm. We have, even to this day, people saying, well, what you do in church is fine, but don't take it out into the public arena. It's fine if you want to have your Christian views in church, but don't take it into the courtroom and the newsroom and the boardroom and things of that nature. And she says, in some respects, we have Christians today that live in that same kind of world, and that's really what we mean by this idea of cultural captivity. Matter of fact, that's the subtitle of her book. So last time we talked a little bit about the survey that we did at Probe Ministries with the Barna Research Group. And what we found was something that, again, is the reason why we've been doing this Bible study every Sunday night. And if you haven't attended, you're still welcome to come. And we watch videos as well as read through a book that is really trying to encourage us to develop a biblical worldview. And in our survey that we did of 18 to 40-year-olds, we found that, again, of all the born-again Christians, only about a third of them have a Christian worldview, 32%. And so that means that, as we looked at last time, on six very important questions that George Barna has used over the years, they gave orthodox answers to those questions. So that's kind of intriguing when you think about it. As I pointed out last time, we had one-third in round numbers that had a biblical worldview and were in church. One-third that did not have a biblical worldview and were in church. And then another third that did not have a biblical worldview and were not in church. And this is of born-again millennials, of at least the leading edge. And they gave us orthodox answers. But then when you took the group of those that at least were thinking biblically, and ask them a number of other questions, for example, about things like Jesus, who he was, whether or not salvation comes only through him, world religions, whether the Bible is accurate in science. We then begin to come down to an even smaller percentage of those. And as I shared with you last time, if you extrapolate those out over a few decades, you come up with some very ominous conclusions. You know, there is no way that we are going to have the church be as vital as it is right now if indeed the future leadership in the church do not have biblical worldviews, biblical practice, and biblical ideas towards the culture. You can see what that is going to mean. And so what I wanted to do today is spend a little bit more time going back to Colossians 2. And if you're there, we're going to look at kind of four false worldviews. And these were worldviews that existed in the time of the Apostle Paul. Ones that he was addressing in the church of Colossae and also, of course, addressing in the church in Corinth. And as we go through this, we're going to use his descriptions of those in Colossians to understand what each one of those might be. And the first one we're going to talk about is what you might call naturalism. If you turn with me to Colossians 2:8, this is the verse we looked at last time. And here Paul says, "See to it that no one takes you captive by philosophy and empty deceit, according to human tradition, according to the elementary spirits of the world, and not according to Christ." And so if you want to, on your handout there, put maybe Colossians 2:8, that will be the one we're going to look at first in terms of naturalism. Now, there's another way to look at this. You know, it says in the book of John, for example, that grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. And what we're going to see here is the different ways in which the words grace and truth are handled by these false philosophies. And I think it would be fair to say that naturalism is where grace is high and truth is low. In other words, it's big on grace, low on truth. Because somebody that doesn't believe in God says, well, I can do anything I want. I can be as immoral as I want because, after all, there's no standard for truth. And so that's this idea where, in some respects, they emphasize freedom, licentiousness, whatever word you want to use, but they're not big on truth. But what do we mean by naturalism? Well, it's the belief that the only natural laws and forces operate in the world. It's the scientific basis for naturalism is, of course, Darwinism. And although naturalism existed before Darwinism, it certainly gave a justification for this idea that I just look at the world and I make all my decisions about it based upon what I see around me. I don't think about whether or not there's a heaven or a hell. I don't think about whether or not there's any absolute moral truth. In some respects, very quickly, there is this idea that there is no divine intervention. And so as a result, everything that we see around here is a result of mass, energy, chance, and time. Now, do we have any proponents of naturalism? Well, here's just a few of those. Upper left-hand corner would be Richard Dawkins. Richard Dawkins is an individual that's written books like, you know, The God Delusion and The Blind Watchmaker, and argues, obviously, that we don't need evolution, anything other than evolution, to explain the world. We don't need God. Lower left-hand corner, when he was alive, Christopher Hitchens, you know, God is not good. Peter Singer in the upper right-hand corner, and Bill Maher in the right-hand corner. These are individuals that would simply say that there is no God, there is no right or wrong, there's no absolute truth, and that is the kind of the philosophy of naturalism. It's also, interesting enough, a belief that religious ideas and moral absolutes are not true. It used to be that atheists would sort of have this idea, well, okay, you Christians, you believe one thing, and we atheists believe something else, and we'll just try to live together. But that's changed rather dramatically now with the so-called new atheists. It says, no, you don't have a right to your views. And if you don't think that this is hostile, you should have been with one of our probe speakers this week, who was down at the University of Texas and also at the Texas State Board of Education when they were debating the biology textbooks. And Dr. Ray Boland, just totally vilified for suggesting that there might be another way to look at origins other than the way it's taught dogmatically in the textbooks. Because no longer is there kind of, well, you can have your view and I'll have my view. It's no, your view is wrong and you do not have a right to have that view. And as a result, views and values today, Pastor Graham talked about vote your values. Think of the values of truth and honesty and integrity and morality. Those are now sort of just seen as code words or symbolic, but they're not true in any real sense. One of the so-called new atheists, Daniel Dennett, actually refers to Darwinism as this universal acid. It's from this idea that if you had an acid that was so corrosive, you couldn't even have a container that would hold it. And so in some respects, because of the teaching of Darwinism, there is now more and more of this belief that, well, there is really no way in which an individual can hold to this, because once you accept the idea that indeed evolution is true, then as a result, you end up with this view that nothing is true. Once you reject biblical ideas and biblical truth, you reject the idea of natural truth or anything else. And so as a result, we can see the impact that it's having. Now, interestingly enough, how do we respond? Well, I think the first thing is to say that we shouldn't put Christianity beneath those elementary principles. That's what we see there in Colossians 2:8, the elementary principles of evolution or the philosophy of naturalism. In the end, we would deny absolute truth, human dignity, and purpose. And one of the leading evolutionists back in the 1950s and 60s was a man by the name of George Gaylord Simpson. He said, man is a result of a purposeless and natural process that not have him in mind. Now, the reason we're here is just a cosmic accident. Now, what's so interesting, before we get into how we as Christians respond, is to recognize that the problem with each one of these worldviews is they fail some key worldview tests. And one of those is correspondence. In other words, they have a view of the world, but it does not correspond with reality. Let me give you a good example of that. There is a professor whose name is Rodney Brooks, and he is a professor at MIT. He's now retired, so he's an emeritus professor. And he wrote a book a number of years ago called Flesh in the Machines, in which he says a human being is nothing more than a machine. A big bag of skin full of biomolecules, he says, interacting with the laws of physics and chemistry. So here's his view, that we're just nothing more than like a biological machine. Tonight, some people are going to watch the HBO special called Westworld, and the concept there is that you can go into this theme park, and these robots, they look like cowboys and Indians and other things like that, are just robots. Well, the premise of the is eventually you're not sure which ones are the robots and which ones are the humans. As a matter of fact, sometimes the robots look more human than the humans do. And so this is, again, just this blurring of distinctions, because after all, we're just a biological machine. So that's his view. But can he live consistently with it? Well, here's what he said. He says, you know, when I look at my children, I can, when I force myself, see that they are machines. But is that how he treats his children? He says, of course not. This is not how I treat them. I interact with them on an entirely different level. They have my unconditional love. The furthest one might be able to get from rational analysis, and here is a good example, I think, of where his worldview does not match reality. And so here, I think, again, we recognize that probably the dominant worldview, especially in the 20th century, and still pretty much the dominant worldview in the 21st century, is this worldview of naturalism. You know, if I open up a newspaper, if I turn on a television program, I go to an internet website, a lot of people, certainly if I go into a university classroom where I've spent many times, it is this view of naturalism. But the problem is, they can't live consistently. I mean, if indeed you're just no different than the animals, there's no different than just any of the rocks out here, then how do you get personality? How do you get personality out of a rock? Think about that. We have personality. Where did that come from? And so again, you can see that there is real tension that even if they say they believe in naturalism and evolution, there's a real tension in trying to live consistently. Well, how do we think about naturalism from a biblical point of view? You might put down Psalm 139 because here it reminds us that God knit us in our mother's womb. And here it shows that God had a purpose. David's reflecting upon God's omnipresence. And here God has a purpose for David. He has a purpose for you as well. He's determined so many aspects of our life, birth, death, and the days that are ordained for me. And interestingly enough, in Acts 17, it even says that God has appointed the times and the boundaries. So really, we recognize that we live in a world where a lot of people reject the idea of God, reject the idea of divine intervention. But if we're Christians, we understand that there's a purpose that God might have. Mike Huckabee talked about sometimes that purpose is a little hard to see when we have that detour, which is part of our destiny. But I think he gave us a couple of good examples of detours in his life that gave us the opportunity to hear from him today. So that's the first of our four worldviews. The second one we find, move down to verse 16. And here, the second set of worldviews that the Apostle Paul was addressing was this, what we call legalism. Therefore, let no one pass judgment on you in questions of food and drink, or with regard to a festival, or a new moon, or a Sabbath. But these are a shadow of the things to come, but the substance belongs to Christ. Now I gave you the description there of grace and truth. Well, in this case, I think oftentimes what legalism is, it's low on grace and high on truth. In other words, it's full of law, but no grace. And so legalism is really kind of a system of morality, or religion or philosophy that imposes God's righteousness on a form of rules and regulations. Some of you may grow up in a church which was really heavy on legalism. It was all full of the thou shalt nots. And if you think that's just a 21st century phenomenon, apparently it was a big issue in the first century as well. And so it's really an attempt to try to produce some kind of righteousness apart from God. And the problem is when you give people this sort of ever-expanding to-do list that is uncoupled with God's grace and God's power, eventually just kind of wear people down. And so that's the legalism issue. Now, do we see that in the church? Well, yes, we do, as a matter of fact. You know, lots of times people identify outside the church, but even people inside the church, with being Christian means that I need to be righteous, I need to be a good witness, I need to dress modestly, I need to avoid addictions. Nothing wrong with all of that, but this is just kind of this long, never-ending to-do list, that legalism. Unless you think that's only a problem inside the church, I was just thinking of some examples outside the church. What's the world say right now? You got to be green. I think I shared 2 weeks ago that if you did a survey of millennials, they found that more millennials said that not recycling is more of an immoral act than watching pornography. You know, talk about how you got your emphasis on the wrong syllable, you know, your cart before the horse. But again, be green or end hunger, help the poor, be a good citizen. Are all those good ideas? Of course they are. But the point is here is where lots of law, no grace. Whether it's inside the church, or sometimes you see some of that even outside the church. And so again, this was something the Apostle Paul was addressing in the first century. Even sometimes we can find ourselves addressing it here today. Well, the dangers of all of this are certainly that we can do all of this in the flesh and yet be righteous. I know Todd and some of the guys went out witnessing yesterday, and I know most of the time whenever I've witnessed to non-believers, sooner or later, and usually sooner in the conversation, they'll say, well, I think I'm a good guy. I think I'm pretty good. You know, do you think you've done enough good to merit favor before God? Maybe. I hope so. I think so. I mean, there's this idea that I think I can do just enough. You know, after all, God grades on the curve, and I'm certainly better than some of those down the street, so, you know, I think I'm going to make my way into heaven. What does it say in Isaiah 64, verse 6? We're all like unclean things. Our righteousness is like what? Filthy rags. And so again, I think it's important to recognize that legalism oftentimes drives people away from the gospel in two ways. First of all, if they're really legalistic, we look at them and go, I don't want to be like those people. You know, I certainly don't want to be in that group. That's not the clique I want to be involved with. But legalism also drives them away from the gospel in that everybody thinks that all they have to do is do enough good works, that somehow they'll merit favor before a holy and righteous God. In some respects, you have to have a diminished view of God, don't you? You have to think that God's just kind of a kindly Santa Claus up there. It's overlooking all sorts of moral failures and things like that. But nevertheless, it is the case. And it also sometimes sends the false message that in order to be a Christian, you have to be a particular kind of person. In other words, you have to vote right, you have to live right, you have to eat right, you have to not do a whole series of thou shalt nots, and that makes you a Christian. And so again, that's another one of those dangerous points of legalism. Another form of legalism, which maybe is more relevant to us in this room and maybe to people we interact with, is the idea of picking and choosing only parts of God's truth that you believe are applicable. And I mentioned just a few minutes ago in the survey that we did of the millennial generation of born-agains, we found that a majority of them said it's okay to pick and choose your religious beliefs, but to follow biblical principles and precepts, neither adding nor subtracting to them. In other words, we have this kind of mindset today that I'm going to create my own religion. Now, if you go down here to Luby's, you know the drill, right? We've all done Luby's. You know, you go and first of all, you look at all the salads and you pick one or more salads you think you want. Then you got the entrees. And by that time you say, oh, the desserts, can't pass that up. You know, and then you look at the tray when you sit down and you say, what have I done to myself? Well, in some respects, that's the mindset that people have about what? Religion. I'm going to pick a little bit of truth here. You know, I heard that on Oprah Winfrey. That sounds pretty good. Pick a little piece here. You know, I heard a pastor say that. And pick another piece here. And I read that in a book. And this is my religion. And that's a different form, but it is a form of legalism. That I'm going to create my own religion. And again, if you think that this is not an issue, look at our survey, the most extensive survey of those 18 to 40-year-old born-again millennials. And we found that a majority of them agreed with this idea that I can pick and choose my religion, which is, again, why we're doing this Bible study. Okay, that's convicting enough. Let's go on to the third one here. We've talked about this idea of naturalism and legalism. Two more real quickly. This one, mysticism. Here, Paul is addressing something else. He says, let no one disqualify you, insisting on asceticism, which we'll come back to in just a minute, and the worship of angels, going on in detail about visions, puffed off without reason by his sensuous mind, and not holding fast to the head, from whom the whole body, nourished and knit together through its joints and ligaments, grows with a growth that is from God. And so here we're talking about this idea of mysticism. And in this case, you can say that it's low on both grace and truth. It has kind of a legalistic element to it, but it doesn't have any kind of emphasis on truth either. And so it really sort of, in many cases, rejects this idea of rational thought. You know, it used to be that East was East and West was West. Rudyard Kipling said that. But no longer. The Eastern ideas have made their way into our culture. And that time, in the first century, these were the so-called mystery religions. Things like Gnosticism and other mystery religions that existed. And so when he is writing to a church with both Jews and Gentiles, he's pointing out that these mystery religions were starting to make their way inside the church. Are we finding that today? Well, again, let's look at some of the practitioners of mysticism. Who's that guy in the upper left-hand corner? Yoda, of course. You're getting a heavy dose of Zen Buddhism. Upper right-hand corner, Eckhart Tolle, you know, and the New Earth and all the Eastern ideas. Matter of fact, you know, he was on Oprah Winfrey. All his books became New York Times bestseller books, and mixing kind of in a syncretistic way all sorts of Eastern ideas and Hindu ideas and things of that nature. Lower left-hand corner, Rhonda Byrne and The Secret. You know, The Secret is you can use your mind to affect reality. And then Deepak Chopra, Seven Spiritual Laws for Success. I mean, you have a tremendous amount of mystical ideas, which again, certainly are quite prevalent outside the church, but we're finding they also are having a very significant cultural influence on people's inside the church. A couple years ago, I remember even having one of the people that were coming to our class tell me that they really liked the writings of some of the people I just put on the screen. So people in the class who went to Prestonwood had read some of the books and liked some of those ideas by Eckhart Tolle and others. And I thought, isn't that interesting? You know, you can't just say that those ideas are out there. And well, how are we going to relate to the world outside the church? Because sometimes those ideas have made themselves inside the church. And of course, they are the ones that are promoting all sorts of things. But one of those ideas is that there are many paths to God. Again, this is damaging for evangelism if you think about it. Because if you go up and say, you know, no one comes to the Father but through me, and you quote from John 14:6, but somebody's in their head saying, no, there are many paths to God. You know, you can come up the mountain on the north side or the south side or the east side or the west side. And again, when we did the survey, the Pro Barna survey, we found that a majority, almost two-thirds of born-again millennials agreed with the statement there could be other ways people could be saved apart from Jesus Christ. So again, you can see this is what's called pluralism, that people have sort of bought into these ideas. And we found, interestingly enough, here it is, 70%. I didn't know I had that chart up there. 70%, so it actually is more than two-thirds, rejected the idea that only one religion is true. Now understand the survey. In order to take this survey, you had to have had a born-again experience that was meaningful in your life and believe that you were saved by grace. Yet, when we then ask them, is Christianity the only way, is a commitment to Jesus Christ the only way a person can be saved, 70% said, no, I think there are other religions that might be true as well. Do you see the point? This is, again, one of the challenges we're going to face in the 21st century. Less than half believe Jesus Christ is the only way to heaven. So it depends on how you ask the question. But you can certainly see, again, how this idea of mysticism is also a growing threat to some of the teachings of biblical Christianity, which is why it's so important to teach God's Word and to really understand what indeed is being taught. But in the interest of time, let me talk now about the fourth particular one, and it sort of is related to the last one, but I kept it as a separate one, because in verses 20 to 23, now Paul says that if with Christ you died to the elementary spirits of the world, why, as if you were still alive in the world, do you submit to regulations? Do not handle, do not taste, do not touch. According to human precepts and teachings, these have indeed an appearance of wisdom in promoting self-made religion and asceticism and severity to the body, but they are of no value in stopping the indulgence of the flesh. The fourth one is kind of a word we don't hear very often, asceticism. But an ascetic would be a person that basically wants to live a life of extreme self-denial. What was being taught in the culture around the church in Colossae and also in Corinth and others is that actually in order to really be spiritual, you had to sort of deny the body. Think about it. The Greeks had that kind of philosophy. The Greeks had the idea that the body was just kind of the caretaker of the soul, so the body had no significance. And so this was something you found among the Jews, the Essenes, from which we got our Dead Sea Scrolls, and the Greeks. If you remember when Paul in Acts 17 is preaching on Mars Hill, to the Stoics, you can see that this is another problem as well. By the way, while I mentioned the Stoics, this week I had a chance to talk to Mr. Duck Dynasty himself, Phil Robertson, and I'm going to play that interview on Wednesday. We taped it, but there is a new film coming out, and it's coming out Friday. Actually, I'm going to see it Thursday night, although I've seen all the previews for it, called Torchbearer. And it's interesting because I was, you know, it's kind of fun. This is about the second or third time I've interviewed Phil Robertson. I was just asking about his experience because, you know, he goes to Athens, he goes to Rome, he goes to the gas chambers in Auschwitz, and he goes to the prison that held Martin Luther King Jr., whatever. But I'd heard that he'd had a positive experience when he was at Mars Hill. And this year, having been to Mars Hill and to see the Parthenon and also being able to stand there, he said, yes, actually, when we did this, they put up all the cameras, and then I had memorized, he said, Acts 17, you know, the message that Paul gives to the Stoic and Epicurean philosophers. And so finally they go, action! And so he gives the message standing there, and he's surrounded by all these tourists, you know, from all over the world, just kind of watching him as he is giving this message of Acts 17 standing on Mars Hill. And when he finished, there were people literally just weeping because of the message that he's giving in the 21st century, which is just a recreation of the message Paul gave in the first century. And he believes that some of those individuals hearing that message on Mars Hill there in Athens actually became Christians. That's reason enough to go watch the film, right? You know, it's called Torchbearer. But anyway, it was just, again, a reminder of the impact that message had for those who believe that really the body was nothing more than just sort of a storage area for the soul, and how Paul's teaching there and preaching and challenging the idols was so different. Well, do we have any ascetics in our world? Well, certainly, you know, Hare Krishna, Tibetan Buddhist monks, all sorts of individuals actually, again, have this idea that in order to achieve some kind of salvation, achieve some kind of ability to get in touch with the divine, that we need to deny the body. And so, again, you can see that the false teachers of that day promoted this idea that humans are just material, but they cannot approach God because he's spiritual. So they had to go through these spiritual entities. And as a result, I think that explains in large part why there was such, as he talks about there, a worship of angels. Now, Suzanne has wonderful angels collections in her home, but sometimes when we've been out traveling, we'll go into a place that has angels, and there are times when I want to just do that, when I walk into the room, because there's these new age places, they're really worshiping angels. And even though, of course, this new book coming out by Jack Graham talks about angels, we're never to worship angels, but I think it also illustrates, again, why there's such an interest in angels among those who hold to asceticism, because after all, the material can't connect with the spiritual, so I'm going to get involved in worshiping angels. Just before I move on, let me just ask a fundamental question. Some people will say, well, is it ever wrong to deny yourself? What did Jesus say in Luke 9? If anyone wishes to come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me. For whoever wishes to save his life will lose it. Whoever loses his life for my sake, he is the one who will save it. So the point is that certainly denial, again, each one of these false views has a little bit of truth. And if they were totally false, then people would reject them, right? So oftentimes what we need to understand is there is a value in certainly denying ourselves and following Christ. But it isn't denying of yourself that brings salvation, which is the argument they make. In the last few minutes, let me just talk about this idea of three views of truth, because it seems to me that what we have today is a real battle for truth. And if we're going to understand these false views, we have to understand that in some respects, we used to live in a culture not so long ago that tended to believe in truth with a capital T. I don't know if any of you in the room ever read a book by Francis Schaeffer, but in the 1970s, Francis Schaeffer was very instrumental in the starting of Pro Ministries, and he used to talk about in his books true truth. I always thought that was kind of interesting, because truth is capital T. Well, no, he understood that even then, people were saying, well, truth is personal. It's relative. You have your view of truth, I have my view of truth, someone else has a different view of truth. It's just a personal truth. And so, if nothing else, just before we go any further, since it's baseball season, and the Texas Rangers look like they're going to have home field advantage all through those playoffs, let's talk a little bit about the story of the three umpires.
You know, there are three different kinds of truth, and I think it's best illustrated by the story of the three umpires. One umpire said, they're balls and they're strikes, and I call them the way that they are. The second umpire said, they're balls and they're strikes, and I call them the way that I see them. The third umpire said, there's balls and they're strikes, and they ain't nothing till I call them. Well, it's a rather humorous way, I think, to illustrate three very different views of truth. The first view is what is known as premodernism. That's the worldview before the modern era. It would be the worldview of the Bible. It is a view that says there are balls and there are strikes, and I call them the way that they are. There is objective truth. God exists. There is revelation, and its result will be that truth is absolute. The second view is known as modernism, that grew up during the Enlightenment, which put much more of an emphasis upon science and theology. It's the view, there are balls and there are strikes, and I call them the way that I see them. There is still truth out there, but truth is now relative. The third view is known as postmodernism. That is the view that there are balls and there are strikes, but they ain't nothing till I call them. In other words, truth is not discovered, truth is created. And everyone has their own view of truth. So as a result, you have the view known as postmodernism. Three views of truth that is best illustrated by the story of the three umpires.
So let's look at those real quickly again. Premodernism is according to the worldview, as I mentioned, of the Bible, and it's the idea that there is a God that it communicated. It was not just the view of the Bible, but it's certainly the view of the idea that indeed truth is absolute and I could discover it. Remember the old phrase, truth is out there. Well, it's the idea they're balls and they're strikes, and I call them what? The way that they are. You know, there is a divine understanding to what truth is. We may see through a mirror darkly. We may not understand all of that, but it's a belief that there is truth because God is truth, right? Well, let's move on to the second one because that's where we find ourselves today. And this is the world of modernism. From the Enlightenment on, you had this idea that, well, I don't necessarily always know truth, but I can discover it from a human point of view by using the scientific method. Nothing wrong with that. I have degrees in science. But the point is the scientific revolution eventually started to reject the idea of God because as scientists began to discover the various forces of nature, they said, you know, I think I can explain the entire world without God. Science is all I need. And so as a result, people there were less likely to see truth as absolute but more relative. And so that has been kind of the dominant worldview in our world. And even to this day, as I said, when you go into a college classroom, it's probably going to be the view of naturalism or modernism. But this is starting to give way to another view, which some people have started to call postmodernism. And this is the idea that there is kind of a rejection of any kind of hope for finding truth. Truth is not discovered. Truth is created. Truth really doesn't exist as much as the individuals want it to exist. And so that's where you get the idea of the third umpire. They're balls and they're strikes, but they ain't nothing till I call them. Now, we can debate whether or not those umpires are going to be helpful to the Texas Rangers or not, but it's, I think, giving you three very different views of truth. And today, we are trying to present the gospel in a world where people are a little bit more unsure about this idea of truth. And so this is important because they would say that truth is just kind of a social construct. There's no absolute truth. They would reject the claim from anyone who believes there's something that is true for everyone, as I've shared in this class before. They reject the idea of mission work because they say, well, wait a minute. You're saying that your view of truth should also be applied to this particular group in Africa, in Asia, in South America, whatever it might be. And they're really skeptical about even being able to arrive at absolute truth. And this has become a real challenge for the gospel. Some of you might remember the various books, Steps to Peace with God, or The Four Spiritual Laws. A lot of those worked real well in a modernistic kind of culture, you know, or spiritual laws. Just there are physical laws in the universe, so there are spiritual laws that govern your relationship with God. I mean, a person that holds to postmodernism are going, wait, I don't believe that there are physical laws. I'm not so sure I believe that there are moral laws. I'm not sure I believe in God. You've got to, in a sense, sort of almost back up a little bit to kind of get into those kinds of ideas. And again, if we think that that is only a problem outside the church, one of the things that has been written by Chris Christian Smith, who is at Notre Dame. He's written all sorts of books on soul-searching, souls in transition, and loss in transition. But he said to try to understand, again, the mindset of a lot of the millennials, they have held to this view, which he calls moralistic therapeutic deism. Big words for simply saying this, that they believe that there's a God who exists and created the universe, that God wants people to be good, nice, and fair to each other, as taught in the Bible and most religions. The central goal of my life is to be happy and feel good about myself. God does not need to be personally involved in my life, and good people go to heaven. And that's where you get this idea of moralistic therapeutic deism. Moralistic, I need to be moral. Therapeutic, God wants me to be happy. And deism is the idea that God created the universe, but he walked away. He's not involved in my day-to-day life. And so you can see that this is the kind of world in which we are now doing evangelism and in which we're doing church programs, and why it's just absolutely key that we come back to God's Word. So let's talk about that. What about truth? How does Jesus view truth? Well, again, here's the perfect antidote to all these false views. Because in John 14:6, Jesus says what? I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father but through me. Either that is true or it is not true. And if it is true, by definition, everything else that we've talked about here is by definition what? False. The problem is a lot of people want to treat truth, and especially religious truth, like flavors of ice cream. I've used this illustration before in class, and it seems to connect better than anything else. You know, which is the best flavor of ice cream? Well, we're going to get a different answer all up and down the aisle here, right? Everybody's going to come up with a different answer probably. Which one's right? Well, it's just preference. But religious truth is not flavors of ice cream. Religious truth is based upon history. Either God exists or God does not exist. Either Jesus is the Messiah or Jesus is not the Messiah. Either Jesus is the Son of God or he is not. Either there is one way to heaven or there is not. See the point? And once you go down that road, you understand that we live in a culture today that, because it's attacking truth, essentially is attacking the gospel and the teaching here even at Prestonwood Baptist Church. Matthew 7:28, but because I speak the truth, you do not believe me. Which one of you commits me of sin? If I speak truth, why do you not believe me? It's a question he asked of the Pharisees, but it's a question he's asking today of our unbelieving culture. And so finally, you know, we see that not only does Jesus talk about that, but Paul reminded Christians in Ephesians 4:21, if you want to put that down as another verse, that truth is in Jesus. Our confidence does not rest in modernism or in postmodernism. It doesn't rest in naturalism or asceticism or mysticism or any kind of false philosophy. Our confidence is in the person of Jesus Christ, who was and who is truth. Parker?